Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we are once again broadcasting from Milan, Italy, where the James Beard Foundation and the International Culinary Center are producing the USA Pavilion. And we are conducting our interview tonight at the James Beard Foundation Restaurant Americana in the Galleria in downtown Milan, right across from the Duomo. And appropriately, we have a six-time nominated James Beard Foundation nominee for the Best Chef of the Northwest, Kathy Wims from Nostrano, Oven and Shaker, and Hamlet Restaurants in Portland. Welcome to Milano. Welcome to the James Beard Restaurant.
I'm so excited to be here, Dorothy. Thank you so much. It's so exciting to be here in Milano and to be cooking at the restaurant Americana here. I'm thrilled.
So have you been to Milan before?
I've been to Milan a couple times before, usually at the beginning or the end of a trip, but I think it might be as long as like 15 years since I've been.
So I was not here for your first dinner last night, but I'm here tonight to eat it. So tell me, how do you find cooking in Italy with Italian ingredients for a pretty demanding crowd?
Well, I can't think of anything more of an honor in my entire career than to come to Italy and actually cook as a head chef, cooking for Italians and other guests. I never thought that would happen. I've worked in restaurants in Italy with friends of mine that are chefs over here, but I've never been the person in charge, so it pretty much is the high point of my career right now.
So we're actually, and you are an Italian-inspired restaurant, and you'll hear the restaurant noises in the background because we are getting ready for service. But let's start out. Are you originally from the Northwest? Tell me a bit about your childhood and your first food memories.
I grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I not only grew up there, I went to college there, the University of North Carolina, and by the time I was 21, I was really ready to go somewhere else. I loved it. It was like the most perfect place to grow up, but it's a small town, and I had kind of hoped to go away to college, so that was when I ended up in the Pacific Northwest.
So, why the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I started in San Francisco. I lived there for a year, and San Francisco was just like, it still is, of course, but even then, back in 1978, it was such an amazing food mecca. Like, it was like nothing I'd ever seen, and I had already become interested in food and had a job as a baker in a really nice restaurant that was a natural foods restaurant in Chapel Hill. And I was cooking all the time in college at home and throwing dinner parties. And to be in San Francisco and just experience this amazing restaurant scene was just quite, it was just mind-blowing for me. And then, but San Francisco was a very expensive place to live at the time for me. I was 21
still
years old. Yeah, that's true. And I even had a rent-freeze apartment, like a two-bedroom apartment, like right where Chinatown meets Nob Hill. So I had it pretty good. But I knew some people from college that had moved to Portland, Oregon, and it was an inexpensive place to live. It was definitely not a restaurant destination. And I kind of... It was a choice between breaking up with my boyfriend or following my boyfriend to Portland, Oregon, and I chose following him to Portland, Oregon. And I'm glad I did in the long run because Portland's really turned into an amazing food town now, 30-some
of which
later.
You've had something to do with. But let's go back to Chapel Hill.
Okay.
So which town did you grow up in? Were you raised on Southern fare?
I grew up in Chapel Hill. I was there for 21 years of my life, and I was raised on Southern fare. Both my grandmothers were really great cooks, and so we ate a lot of traditional foods like fried chicken, and we had rice on the table more often than bread. Carolina rice is such a big deal in the South. We had lima beans. I met people like later, and I was saying, I love lima beans, don't you? And they say, ooh, lima beans, those are like the ickiest thing ever. And I was like, what are you talking about? They're so delicious. And what I realized was they were eating canned or
yes.
frozen lima beans, and I was eating like fresh shucked lima beans that my grandmother would make for me. So, and what else did we have? We had country ham for breakfast with red eye gravy, and my mom would make biscuits, and she was busy. She worked full time, so
and she made biscuits
well, on the weekend. We had grits for breakfast during the week for school breakfast, and it was I don't think I appreciated it as much as I do now that I'm older. I think I kind of turned my back on Southern food, and now I'm realizing, how wonderful it was and how lucky I was. And actually, the similarities between Southern food and Italian food that I've spent most of my career, loving and trying to learn more and more about.
So what were you like when you were 12 years old? That's an awkward age, but where was your head in those days? What did you think you were going to do when you grew up?
When I was 12 years old, I was definitely very awkward, that's for sure. I was very tall. I was always the tallest person in my class. I was very clumsy. My father used to have a joke because I always hitting my head or running into a wall or tripping over my own feet. And when I would do that, he would say, coordination strikes again.
And
oh, kind of mean.
Yes.
He had a mean side to him. But I don't think, I always loved food. I remember telling my mother that for my birthday, and I probably was around 12 years old, somewhere between 10 and 12, that for my birthday dinner, I wanted to have prime rib. Mm-hmm. But I asked her, Mom, can I eat it with my hands?
The whole prime. You meant the bone.
I just wanted to tear into it. No, I don't think I just meant the bone. I just wanted to pick it up and chew on it.
Wow.
So, but my sister, I have one sister, younger sister, and we always enjoyed helping my mom cook, and she was a very good cook. She didn't know how to cook at all when she got married, and she got married young when she was 21 and had me a year later, and then my sister a year and a half later. And she taught herself to cook, and she learned the dishes that my grandmothers made. And I know there was some frustration that she had. Her mother made chicken and dumplings, and every time we went to go visit her in Newport News, Virginia, where my mother grew up, my grandmother would make us always chicken and dumplings, and that was what her to make when we came to visit. And she would hand what Northwest think of dumplings when they think of chicken and dumplings. It's like kind of a drop biscuit dropped into broth. But what she made was really like a version of pasta, even though there's no Italian in my family. It was like a dough that she rolled out with a rolling pin and cut in squares, kind of like, not unlike pappardelle. And I think, I don't know for sure because I never learned to make it from her, but I think that there might have been a little bit of baking powder in the dough because it kind of puffed up a little bit, but still it was a lot closer to pasta than it was to what most people think of as these, round biscuity dumplings, cakey dumplings. So that was another thing, like the lima beans that I was talking about, when I would tell people about chicken and dumplings, and they would make it, I would be like, this isn't chicken and dumplings. It wasn't the chicken and dumplings that I knew.
So when you went to college, what did you study?
I was a Latin major in college, which is...
Is that the Italian connection? Why Latin?
I think that's what started it. Well, I know exactly why Latin. Well, one, I always chose exotic things. And I hadn't, in North Carolina, if you went to public school, which I did, they didn't teach Latin. Like, Latin was an option. So I think it seemed really exotic to me. But it was probably a really dumb choice because I had to do a lot of catching up to be a major in it. But what happened was my freshman, my first freshman term, I got invited to be in this this seminar that was in the classics department, and I was probably going to be an English major. That was probably where I was headed. Well, the English classes that I signed up for had like 45 people in them, and this freshman seminar, classics seminar, where we read things like Herodotus and I can't remember now. Anyway, there was like 9 people in the class. And I thought, I like this. You know, this is really great. And I remember the first day of class, there was all 9 of us were sitting in the classroom, like waiting for our professor. And it was like 10 minutes late, and we're like, are we in the right place? And literally, this is like the first day of school for me, of college for me. And we're waiting and we're waiting, and then finally, like, the door opens like really slowly, and like really slowly, this really sort of stooped over old man like slowly like shuffles to his desk in front of the classroom, and we're all kind of like rolling our eyes at each other like, what's this going to be? It's like, this is going to be really boring. And he sits down and he starts talking, and like everything about like Greek history, it was a Greek history seminar, just comes alive, and my eyes were like wide open. And when you read Greek history, like those crazy things, like these stories by Herodotus, like they take like a king's dream as serious as a true fact, and that all just seemed so magical to me. And at that moment, I decided that I wanted to be in the classics department because it was just something so new and exciting. I had yet to know that I was going to become in love with Italy.
Whoa, what a great story. Does it make learning Italian easy, having that Latin base?
I think it helps with my Italian. I've actually been really happy here, Dorothy, in Milan, because the accent is so easy to understand. I have a setback, and I've been studying Italian for many years, but I've never lived in Italy. Like, I've always been visiting, and a lot of the people that I know, the chefs and the winemakers, speak like perfect English. So it's kind of hard for me to practice my Italian. But it's like I'm having a great time, like talking with cab drivers and just like chefs and waiters and all kinds of people. It's like, not just the basic like, I would like to order this and blah, blah. It's like, it's really been having real conversations. So it's been a great trip that way.
That's great. So, when you were graduating college and enjoying your classics, the June you graduated, what did you think you were going to do on your life's journey? What was your next step?
Well, the boyfriend that I followed to San Francisco, he was a classics major, and he spent his junior year abroad in Rome. And so he was always telling me about Rome. And at the same time, I was really interested in cooking. I was cooking in my apartment like all the time and just throwing impromptu dinner parties. I was working for a fishmonger who set up twice a week in a parking lot on Rosemary Street in Chapel Hill. And he would give me fish.
You were working for him, meaning selling fish?
Selling fish, yeah. And he would always give me the whatever I wanted of the leftover fish at the end of the 2 days that he would come into town. And so I would have this like beautiful fish, so I'd like be making like fish stews, inviting people over,
but they were delicious.
It was really fun. And I don't know. I think somehow, hearing these stories about Rome and cooking both French and Italian food, that it just kind of all started to gel, and I just decided that I think all cooks and who become chefs when they start are, most of them it seems like, are really fascinated with French food, and I was too, because it just seems like it's the height of all gastronomy. But I don't know, I just really grew to love the simplicity of like pasta and like great sauces, and And it was also...
Where were you eating Italian food in those days?
Well, there wasn't really that much. I mean, since Chapel Hill was a university town, there was a lot of different ethnic restaurants, like most university towns. But I don't remember any particular great restaurant. There was a Greek restaurant that had pizza on the menu, and they had pizza with feta and mushrooms and oregano. That was, like, my favorite thing. But there wasn't really a great Italian restaurant. There was a French restaurant called La Residence that was kind of the special occasion place that my parents, you know.
So where do you get it? If you're, you know, your parents or your mother is cooking Southern food, there's not a great Italian restaurant. Where did all of this love of Italian food to inspire truly your career come
from? I think, one, there was the Foods of the World series, and I had...
Oh, from Time Life.
Yeah, Time Life, Foods of the World series, and I had the Foods of Italy. So I kind of cooked my way through that. And I can't remember exactly the year that Marcella's first, Hazan's first book came out, classic Italian cookbook. But I think it was right before... I think I was still in college. Like, I think I was a junior in college, so... I had that, and I started cooking my way through that. And I remember my mother took a cooking class from Judith Olney, who was Richard Olney's sister-in-law, and she learned to make pesto. And she came home the day that, you know, she learned to make pesto and said, "Oh, my God, I made the most amazing thing." And then she made it for us the next day. And I think just kind of all, it just kind of kept, like, steamrolling that way.
It sounds delicious. So we're going to take a little break here, and we'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and we're broadcasting from Milan, Italy at the James Beard Restaurant in downtown Milan, across from the Duomo in the Galleria. And we're featuring all through the expo and through now to October 31st, 2015, the best and the brightest of American chefs. Twice a week, American chefs will come in and do their interpretation of American food in Italy. And today, I'm very proud to have as a guest on the show Kathy Wims from Nostrano in Portland, Oregon. So, Kathy, we're out in San Francisco, but we've moved up to Portland. Tell me what Portland was like in 1978. You went up there?
79. I moved 79? Up 78 to 79. I was in San Francisco, and then we moved in 79. And to me, Portland was a very dark and rainy place where everyone that I knew hung out in taverns with basically blacked out windows and played pool. And I remember thinking, why did I move here? What is this all about? And the one thing that that kind of salvaged Portland for me is that I actually got a job in the only restaurant that wasn't a tavern with blacked out windows. It actually had, like, clear windows that let the sun in, and it had ferns hanging in the windows. This is 1979, after all. And it was famous for the place in Portland that had 250 kinds of beers from all over the world. And I got a job there the day I got off the plane. My my boyfriend was friends with the owners, and I ended up working there for, like, off and on for 6 years. And it was...
In the kitchen,
and pouring beer. I wouldn't call it cooking. You know, I didn't think of it as cooking because I'd already kind of... It was just making sandwiches. And
did you not want to do anything with your classics education?
Well, I think the thing about classics is that, you know, you really, to go forward, you would really go to graduate school. And I kind of was veering away from that, so.
And you were loving cooking.
I did. Yeah. I really did, but I wasn't a very good sandwich maker. In fact, if you ask anyone that worked with me back then, they'll say that of all the people that worked at, the place was called Produce Row Cafe because it was in the produce district of Portland, Oregon, and most of the produce companies were Italian and had been there for years and years, and it was, but it was a warehouse district. But if you ask anyone that I worked with, they would say that I was the worst cook there of all. So I guess I didn't take that part very seriously.
That's interesting. How do you make a bad sandwich?
Oh my gosh, I can make a bad sandwich. I think I try and put too much in the sandwich always. I don't have enough restraint to make a sandwich.
Well, that's a good, you know, that sounds great. I don't have enough restraint to make a sandwich. So what was your journey from there to Nostrano?
Well, I hadn't finished my Latin degree. Portland State didn't have anything. Didn't have it. I kind of started all over again. And I was taking a bunch of dance classes. I had got excited about modern dance in at University of North Carolina, and so there was a proposed dance major, and I was taking a bunch of dance classes, hoping that, you know, thinking that that was going to go through, and then that got canceled during the Ronald Reagan budget cuts, and so then there I was again with like, oh, I don't have a major. So about the same time, I had friends that were working at this restaurant called the Bread and Ink Cafe, and it was a sister restaurant to the nicest sort of special occasion restaurant in Portland called Genoa. And people that had worked at Genoa had gone to open this restaurant, and my girlfriend worked at Bread and Ink Cafe, and it was a great, really high-end cafe. And she heard people saying, oh, they need a cook at Genoa. And she piped up and said, you know, you should call my roommate. She cooks all the time. She's always throwing dinner parties. And so they actually called me out of the blue. And I had eaten at Genoa, but it was like, basically, it was like saving up for 6 weeks to be able to pay. You know, I was still in my 20s. And I would never, I was dying to work there, but I would never have even knocked on the door. Because I didn't have a culinary education. And I just assumed that, you know, everyone that worked there had probably gone to culinary school. And out of the blue, I got this call while I was at Produce Row Cafe.
Was the ownership, was the chef Italian, or were they American?
Her family was Italian. She was half Italian. Amelia Hard was her name.
And she was the chef?
She was the chef and the owner.
Uh-huh. And so what station did they put you in?
So my first station was pasta.
And our first station was pasta.
First station was pasta. It was divided up with the entree cook, the fish cook, and the pasta cook. And that was like how we didn't have, in fact, I didn't until like recently, like even understand like culinary terms, like, you know, like chef de cuisine and sous chef, like that. This was a counterculture restaurant. It just, you know, just happened to be a bunch of passionate, like, college kids, mostly from Reed College, which is also in Portland.
That's James Beard's alma mater.
That's right.
Absolutely. Right. We're talking and Steve Jobs. Right.
Yes, yes.
Well, it was Steve dropped out in the freshman year, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
and James Beard got thrown out, I believe.
Oh, did he really? Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that.
And so these sort of dreamers who were mostly like artists who, you know, as we all know, it's hard to make money as an artist, you know, sort of as their sort of second thing, were really into cooking, and that was kind of what founded Genoa. And then I remember the first day I was there, it was really the end of August, beginning of September, and it was like one of those 100-degree days that only happened for like 3 or 4 days in the summertime in Portland. We have very like mild summers. And there was a cold pasta on the menu, so there was hot fettuccine. We made our own fettuccine. But the sauce was a cold sauce, so we tossed the hot pasta with the cold sauce. And so my first job was to make the sauce before the night started. So it was tomatoes and Kalamata olives, which are kind of the gourmet olive of that era, and extra virgin olive oil, which I couldn't believe they were actually using, and basil. And so I was sort of blown away by the quality of the ingredients they were giving me, and I was like looking over, and the entree chef was flaming like veal scallopini with like real cognac, like not just American brandy. And I was just kind of, and we were flavoring, you know, whipped cream with like real Grand Marnier. And I was like, whoa, like what have I like really stepped into like nirvana here. And I never looked back. And I worked my way through to up to the fish cook and then to the entree cook and then to pastry chef and eventually to the head chef was called the menu chef. And there were four different people that shared it. This responsibility, and it rotated every 2 weeks. And so eventually that, it was actually not kind of dissimilar from the sort of the counterculture quality of Chez Panisse, and it actually opened the same year. Genoa opened in 1971. It's the same year Chez Panisse opened.
So is it still there now?
It is. It closed like within the last 2 or 3 years.
Oh.
It's very sad. It's a real Portland institution. Uh-huh. And then eventually I was able to buy the restaurant, and I owned it for 13 years. And
as Genoa.
As Genoa, yeah. And that was kind of like a dream come true. And then,
so when you took over Genoa and bought it, what did you change and what did you keep?
What did I change and what did I keep? Well, what I kept was, luckily, of staff that stayed there for a really long time. Like, I had been there by when I was owner like 7 years, but we had other cooks that had been there like 15 years, and you know, eventually I was there for 20 years. One of my favorite chefs, he was there for 24. I mean, there was just this amazing longevity, and I think it was because it wasn't a hierarchical kitchen. It was, people shared culinary ideas like all the time. We were always, while we were working, talking about what recipe we were trying out, talking about a new cookbook that came out, you know, going home and trying out recipes. It was just this constant, like, people just fed off each other. I didn't mean that as a pun. but it was just a really creative environment with really creative people. Like, one of my fellow entree chef, she was a potter. She had one of her pots was in the Smithsonian Museum in Washington. Another was a really accomplished oil painter. People just, they were really, it was a really creative, like, bed of people that just had ended up at this restaurant because it was.
How many
was
seats did it have?
30. It was very small.
And how many covers a night would you have done?
A busy, busy night would be like 65. And it was a 7-course pre-fee meal.
Oh.
So everybody got the same thing. It actually was a, I miss it so much now because it was a control freak's dream. Like, no, the customer didn't have any choice of what they were going to have except for a choice of one of three entrees, and there was a dessert tray that had 7 different desserts. Otherwise, everything was a set menu. And we all put a ton of work into those set menus, and really, we worked really hard, and then again, that would rotate like every 2 weeks, and then someone else would take over, and that person would act as head chef for that period and do all the ordering and maintain the quality and, you know, train people to make any like new dishes that they put on. So it was a great experience, but it was very different than a traditional kitchen, I think.
Okay, well, we're going to take another break here, and then we're going to come back and find out how your grand finale. Now there's three restaurants. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the James Beard Foundation restaurant in Milano, Italy, during the World Expo here, which runs from May 1st to October 31st. Heartily recommend if you can get on a plane and get over here. It's an amazing exhibit, 53 countries, wonderful World's Fair. Anyway, today on our show, we have one of our best and brightest American chefs who are being featured in the James Beard restaurant in Milan, across from the Duomo, atop the Galleria. It's a spectacular space, and we have spectacular talent. And today it's Kathy Wims from Portland, Oregon, of Restaurants Nostrano, Oven and Shaker, and a great cocktail bar called Hamlet. So tell us about those three incarnations.
Okay. Well, Nostrano is my baby. It's the restaurant that I have the most passion for. It's turning 10 years old in October this year. And
you were running Genoa and opened Nostrano.
I left Genoa, and then I call it in the wilderness, without a job. And I actually finally went back. I went back to school a million times, but I actually got my undergraduate degree during that.
At this time, what did you actually graduate
in? It was basically in liberal arts. It was a general liberal arts major. But it was really fun to go back to college in my 50s, or late 40s, I guess. So what was the question now? Oh, Nostrano. Yeah. Oh, so what had sort of happened for me as culinary-wise is that when I ended up buying Genoa, I became the wine buyer. So I was responsible for ordering the wine for the list and for tasting
wine.
In
addition to cooking.
In addition, yeah. And it was a fun new thing for me. You know, I really learned a lot. But what was great about it is that Genoa was ostensibly an Italian restaurant. But we let a lot of other influence sort of creep in. And so I was buying wine, and I met a lot of Italian winemakers would come through and taste me on their wine. And invariably they would say, you know, why don't you come visit the winery in Italy? We have an apartment. You could stay there. And it's like, this all started to sound like really good. So I started traveling to Italy. And the more I traveled in Italy, the more I realized that the food that I thought was Italian that I was cooking, and again, I've never been trained in Italian food. I've just cooked out of books like Marcello Zan and Time Life Foods of Italy book and other ones. And I realized that the food I was eating in Italy was much more restrained and much more ingredient-driven and less like technique and complexity driven. And I also, at the same time, with these winemakers, when they would visit town, we would often have a special dinner featuring their wine. And I would ask them, like, you know, what do you think of the food? And sometimes I would say, oh, you know, it was very good. And it's like, wow, I'm not really getting the answer I really want. and then again, I'm like going to Italy and I'm simpler and simpler food. And I kind of finally just said, wait, I really don't know what I'm doing. I think I'm cooking Italian food, but I don't. And so I started really paring back and really trying to pay attention. And then I started getting compliments from Italians that were visiting. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I'm figuring it out. And it's like, so I really had to sort of unlearn what I had learned, which I think is really interesting. And it was a long process.
Give me an example of a meal you had in Italy, one of the first times you were here, where you saw the simplicity was really the heart of it.
I remember being, I don't know if I remember the exact meal, but I loved when you would go in a trattoria and there would be like a simple, like chicken fricassea, as you would say in Italian, or fricassee, like on the menu, and the chicken would just taste so amazing. And the thing, what happened in the process of the cooking is that when an Italian makes a chicken fricassea, like they cook it until the flavors in the sauce itself go into the chicken. And so the chicken becomes something even greater than itself. And I'd be like, what is with this chicken? It's like the best chicken I've ever had. And that, so that I think that was something that made me like, okay, so This fricassee might have cherry tomatoes in it, might have a few olives, it definitely has some white wine, but it's cooked until the chicken's almost falling off the bone, and those flavors are within the chicken meat at that point in the way that they're cooked. And for me, that was, I think that's sort of emblematic of Italian food. It's like, oh, we can take these very few ingredients, and yet what emerges at the end is something really quite different.
Mm. Mm. I'm so hungry.
We're going to eat in a little bit.
Yeah, we are going to eat in a little bit. So, so Nostrana, now you've got your restaurant. What are the three major things that you wanted from that restaurant for a customer to go in? And what did you want them to feel? What was your emblematic mark?
Well, Nostrana in Italian means ours, as in yours and mine. But it also has a stronger meaning to Italians in that it's used to describe something that is right from the very place that you're in. So if I was in a market in Milano and I was looking at vegetables and fruits or fish or whatever, if that vegetable or fruit or fish was from the area, like right around Milano, it would say Nostrana or Nostrano or Nostrani, you know, whatever the adjective needed to match. And with that comes an Italian pride that this is the best because this is from our area. It's just the flavor that I know, and it's more highly regarded, and actually an Italian is willing to pay more for that. And so I love that philosophy, and that's what I really wanted my customers to be able to grasp. And luckily, like Italy, the Pacific Northwest has an amazing, like, right around Oregon, like, around Portland, like, 45 minutes out is, like, at least, you know, like, 50 different farmers that I can source from, you know, nine of which are...
Do you source directly from the farm?
Exactly, we do. And so...
Do they bring it to your door? How do you...
They bring it to our door. I mean, I also shop in the farmer's market to add things, but most they bring it to our door, and mostly the same, you know, 90% of those farmers I've had since we opened Nostrana, and many of them came from when I was working at Genoa too. So it's really long-term relationships with the farmers, and beautiful produce that I and meats that I don't really have to do that much to. So.
Tell me what's unique to the Northwest that if you go to cook anywhere else you miss.
Well, I think the variety of produce. Like, what I love about our farmers markets is that each vendor almost has their own, like, curated, like, group of special vegetables that the next vendor down probably doesn't have, at least in that that variety. And it's like each farmer is like has their own curated boutique of vegetables. Like they might have their, you know, four different kinds of beautiful, colorful eggplants. And then you go down, and the next farmer in the next booth, you know, his specialty might be chicories, like winter chicories of all different kinds, Italian varieties. And then the next farmer might be, oh well, I grow Spanish. Style asparagus, both white and green and purple, or I and grow padron peppers because that's a Spanish thing. So that variety is just like amazing, and it's just a dream for a chef or a cook to just be able to choose that way. I love farmers markets. I go to them in every city that I can when I'm traveling, and a lot of times like. And it sometimes has to do with the climate, but like every stall can almost have a very similar quality to it, where it's the same hybrid tomato, it's the same hybrid eggplant that grows in that climate. And there's nothing wrong with that, it's all beautiful produce, but the variety that we have is just kind of unmatched.
So running a great restaurant, how many seats does Nostrana have?
Nostrana has 80 seats, and we just opened our outdoor patio, and so that brings it up to 115.
My gosh. And what made you want to open other places? Because that's quite an intense situation.
It's really big. And I, as you remember, I came from a restaurant that was a control freak's dream. We only had 35 seats. You know, the maximum we did was 60 people. And I never wanted a big restaurant. It just kind of happened. We found a space. It was a big space. It was a beautiful space. And I had business partners at the time, and they really wanted to go for it. And I was like, when we opened, we didn't know what we were doing. I didn't know what I was doing. I was so overwhelmed. And we got a lot of great press from the local paper, the Oregonian, and we were swamped. I mean, I barely remember the first year we opened. So it was just a thing I walked into. It probably wasn't the smartest thing I've ever done, but. But now that we're turning 10, you know, I can look back and feel really good about it.
So tell me about Oven and Shaker.
Well, Oven and Shaker is a collaboration between two other business partners. One is oversees all the finances and the book work. And my other partner is the Shaker part of Oven and Shaker. So he's a mixologist. His name's Ryan McGarren. He's a very famous consultant for mixology, all over the world. I'll be talking to him, and he said, I'm going to Hong Kong tomorrow, you know, to open this bar in a hotel. Or, I'll be in Berlin. So he's always traveling, but he makes beautiful, beautiful cocktails. And the oven part of Oven and Shaker refers to the wood-burning oven. And so it's a pizzeria with really beautifully curated cocktails by my partner.
So was it the 10-year itch that, you know, you felt, I want to open another place with doing other things, and Hamlet too?
Well, I think it was really probably a 7-year itch. Because
that's just like the movie.
Because I think we finally got to the point where Nostrana seemed to be running really well. We had come through a really severe economic decline in 2006 and 2007, and we was really sketchy if we were going to be able to make it. And we made it through that, and then we had a cohesive, amazing staff, which I still have, which many of them are in the kitchen cooking right now, our dinner for tonight. And I just felt really good. And Ryan McGarren, my partner, the Shaker, the mixologist part, he walked into the restaurant one busy Saturday night, and I happened to be walking the floor. And he said, wow, this is great. You have this busy restaurant. You must be so proud. I want to have my own place someday. And I said, wow, I was just thinking, I really want to open a pizzeria, because originally Nostrana was supposed to be a pizzeria, and then we found this huge 80-seat place and decided we needed a full menu. And I said, wow, I'd like to open a pizzeria. And he said, I've been talking to this business consultant, Kurt Huffman, who is our partner now. And at that week, that very week, someone called me with a failed pizzeria that a Milanese couple had started because they wanted to create a pizzeria in their hometown of Milan. And they said, this space is open, you know, you should look at it. Really? All that happened within a week. And the next thing I knew, I had a second restaurant.
How long did it take you to open that one?
Oh, I think we worked on it for maybe 7 months, I think. It always takes longer than we think. You know, I think we probably thought we were going to open in 3 months.
And how many seats in that?
That has also 80 seats.
Oh, so another small one.
Another small restaurant. Right. But it's a little simpler, you know. It's basically just pizza, appetizers. And
how long has it been open?
We will turn 3 in October.
A lot easier than Ristorano?
It is easier, but we also, when you know it's your second restaurant, you kind of open it with a strong managerial team, so, you know, so it can run. It, you can't be every
backup.
Place at once. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about Hamlet and why that came out.
Hamlet just opened. Literally, I can't believe I'm here in Milan. It literally opened a week and a half ago. And
must have a great staff.
I do have a great staff. And it's right around the corner from Oven and Shaker. And it's literally in the same building. And we were kind of busy right from the start when we opened the pizzeria. And we, for a good part of the evening on a busy night, turned people away for about 2 hours. And a bar that was sort of, you know, kind of failed, came to us and said, you know, would you like to take over our lease and kind of made sense. We hadn't even pre-thought about it. So we were sending people to other bars, our neighbors that we liked too, but we thought, well, we could send them to our own bar. So that kind of happened also without, I feel like a lot of my career sort of happened when it just sort of fell
in my lap. Yeah, when do you have time for yourself? And when you do, what do you do?
Oh, well, I come to Milan and cook dinner for the James Beard Foundation.
You stole this time because you'd be at Hamlet right now. Right?
I know, it's true. Well, you know, I'd already committed to this, so everyone was very supportive and was very supportive of me coming here. And you know, I trust that it's going really well. And, you know, I'm really, my former chef at Oven and Shaker is now the chef of Hamlet, and my former GM at Oven and Shaker is actually being the general manager for both places. And so it's a lot of like longevity there that allows.
Life gets easier, right?
It kind of sort of does.
Are you going to take any more days while you're here?
I'm going to Bologna tomorrow with my chef team, and the five of us are going to hang out there.
Why Bologna?
Well, we know this amazing young woman. Her name's Francesca Torri, and she's in her early 20s, and she has taken it on of preserving the century-old tradition of hand-rolling pasta with a huge, long rolling pin and teaching people how to do that through cooking classes. And she came to Nostrana. Some friends of mine had met her, taken a class from her, and then brought her to their cooking school in Eugene, Oregon, and asked me if I would like to share some of the responsibility of flying her over from Bologna. And I said, that's great. So we closed Nostrana for a whole day. My entire kitchen staff learned how to hand roll pasta. And then that night we opened and just served the pasta that we made. And my staff was so excited. She was such a charming person. And her brother, Tommaso, came with her. And we were just so excited about learning this, like, I mean, it's not easy to hand roll pasta, and it's very time consuming.
How long is the rolling pin?
Oh my God, what do you think?
A meter?
A meter? Yeah,
yard?
I think so.
Yeah,
it's really long. It's not something you can really just walk down the street with, you know, or put in your backpack. So it's really long, and you have your own wooden board with like a back on the back that holds, you know, the flour from falling, you know, off the board, and then it also has a sort of slab underneath that holds it to the table. So when you push against the board when you're kneading the pasta or rolling the pasta, the board doesn't slide off the table.
You know, you really don't understand how much goes into pasta. You know, 20 regions of Italy, and each one is different. I mean, the little lip on the board, how fascinating. Oh, I'm so jealous going down there. I think I've got to meet this woman myself.
Well, I think, you should. Yeah. Oh, she's
tell her
amazing.
I'm coming.
Okay,
I've got to roll out some
pasta. I will, Dorothy. But, you know, it's like that's the other thing about Italian food is that it's so deceptively simple, but yet to, like, hand roll out pasta. And then when you realize when you eat the pasta that's hand rolled, the connection between the wooden rolling pin and the wooden board and the beautiful eggs and the flour, like, adds so much more texture than actually rolling it through, a metal
machine,
which still is great pasta, too. But it's like those levels of, like, oh, well, this is really at a whole nother level. And it's also about preserving, you know, traditions like that, which is so, you know, we're losing those.
Oh, my gosh. This has been such a great conversation. I'm sorry. Not only does it have to come to an end, but you have to cook.
Okay.
I mean, and about this, the people are starting to come in, I think.
Some polenta to fry, I believe.
I do. Well, thanks so much for being in Milan, doing this for the James Beard Foundation, the U.S. Pavilion, and it's really been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you, Dorothy. Thank you for having me, and thank you to Heritage Radio Network, too.
Oh, great. And just a shout-out, Jack Inslee, thanks to my producer, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.